All right, so welcome to the Innovation Conversation Series. Today's conversation is proudly brought to you by Northern Illinois University and the Office of Innovation. The goal of these facilitated dialogues is to encourage research, scholarship, artistry, and entrepreneurship while having engaging conversations with leading experts from around the world on a multitude of relevant topics that are related to food systems innovation, and sustainability. For today's event, we'd like to welcome Mark DeSantis. Mark is the CEO of Bluefield, a venture-backed ag tech company that helps specialty crop growers across the US, EU, and South America. Earlier in Mark's career, Mark held a policy position as a senior policy analyst in the White House, Office of Science and Technology Policy in the administration of George H.W. Bush. And Mark is also an advisor to MIR Ventures in Palo Alto and Cascadia Capital in Seattle. And he is an adjunct professor of entrepreneurship at Carnegie Mellon University. Good afternoon, Mark, and welcome to the Innovation Conversation.
Thanks, Brian. It's a privilege to be here.
Much appreciated. So let's start off, as we always do, by you telling us a little bit about yourself and what made you follow the path that you've chosen.
Sure. Well, you know, I've had a winding path in my life to get to where I am. It started and mentioned in government in Washington, D.C. I had the good fortune of working for some very, thoughtful elected officials. I worked on Capitol Hill, worked for two congressmen, one of whom was Tom Ridge, who became the governor of Pennsylvania and the first head of Homeland Security, and then another one who as a congressman, now he's the governor of Ohio, is Mike DeWine. And then subsequently worked for the late Senator John Hines, who was a senator from Pennsylvania. And then that led me to the White House under the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And then ultimately, I was a lobbyist for Texas Instruments. So I finished that career. All of that was done before the age of 35. So I had done that, and I found that experience really enriching, and I learned a lot. But I really, right around the year 2000, wanted to, as many of your listeners may recall, back in the day, there was the dot-com boom in the late 90s, early 2000s, and I got caught up in that, and I ended up joining a company called Free Markets that ultimately got acquired by Ariba. Mm-hmm. And so my early exposure to entrepreneurship led me to found a number of companies along the way, and I've had some good luck. I've sold a few. Not all were wildly successful, some not so much. That's the game. I think everybody who is considering entrepreneurship has to know that you win some, you lose some.
Just have to win more than you lose, right?
Yeah, you just have to get a little bit better. I always just tell my students I have the most expensive graduate education you could possibly imagine. It's cost tens of millions of dollars to get my degree, my sort of equivalent of a degree. Mostly I would say the startups that I've been involved with and co-founded are in what a friend of mine, business venture capitalist, euphemistically calls big and boring problems. Mm-hmm. And in my humble opinion, those are the ones where technology often can make the biggest difference.
Right.
So for example, one of my companies, we help people buy and sell wholesale power in spot markets across the United States. General Electric was one of our biggest investors and a partner. Previous company, we used AI to inspect road surfaces for public works departments for 200 plus cities around the world, including London, England, Toulouse, France, Los Angeles, Detroit, Melbourne, Australia, all around the world. And then this one, in a similar vein, is agriculture, where who's going to look at the crops? Right. I got to know how my peaches are doing. And if I have hundreds, if not thousands of acres of peaches or apples or what have you, I really don't know how they're doing. I just have to guess. So AI to do that as well. So it's a long and winding road. Mm-hmm. There are some themes in there. So I ask the listeners to discern those themes and send me a note and tell me what they are, and then I'll have a better sense of what my life was all about. But that's what I've done.
That's an amazing, to have all of that done by 35, you really had your roller skates on in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
So Then tell us a little bit, right? So you're the CEO of Bluefield. So tell us a little bit about Bluefield, and and then we can kind of delve into the robotics and the ag piece of it.
Yeah, sure. I think of that's a way of explaining this. And I've been at this company 5 years, and I was really completely new to ag at the time that I started this company, though I did have experience when I was a child. My Italian immigrant grandfather had a 1-acre garden in his backyard, and he used to walk around and grow tomatoes and peppers and all that. And one of the things that he did is he was constantly in the garden. So he's constantly looking at these crops that he was growing, and he was applying treatments to them. As a 9-year-old, I just sort of used to watch him. And he was, in order to know what to do to the plants, he had to go into the garden and look at them.
Right.
And that's really how crops should be going. They should, particularly specialty crops, they need a lot of love and attention. But when you're an industrial grower, growing hundreds, if not thousands, or in some cases, our customers have 100,000 acres around the world, it's really nearly impossible to give that kind of love and attention. In fact, quite frankly, let's use a vineyard. A viticulturist might only be able to inspect a tenth of an acre on a 100-acre vineyard. Now scale that up to thousands of acres, and you see the problem. Even if you employed multiple people to inspect it, you'd still have a very significant problem. I had that problem with road inspection in my prior company. If you give the same X-ray to 4 radiologists, no matter how dedicated, highly trained, you're going to get 4 opinions.
Right.
And that's just human nature. Mm-hmm. And so what would be a way that one could inspect all of their apple trees and every apple on that tree consistently, inexpensively, on a continuous basis? Mm-hmm. And that's where the basis for our company is. So essentially, we have a camera that uses a dual lens and its own light source. It's about the size of a toaster. Mm-hmm. And it attaches to really anything that moves. We've been on 42 kinds of vehicles that exist on every farm in the world, and we just hitch a ride. So the vehicle might be doing other things, and while it's moving within the rows, the image, the camera and the light source and the lenses are imaging every plant, and importantly, geolocating every plant. So it knows that as it's imaging that plant, it knows that's vine 6, row 7.
Right.
So they're going to, we're into our fifth year now, and we've been inspecting the same vines in some cases for 3 years. So we've been watching this, it's like a proud father. I've been watching vine 6, row 7 grow through the years. And so what do we look for? Well, we use artificial intelligence, deep learning, a version of it, which was developed by Carnegie Mellon. And proudly, as an adjunct professor there and a company that was spun out of there, I can say that CME was ranked, I think, number one in the world last year of all universities in the world in artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons they make that claim is they're very good at perception. So the ability of a machine to know what it's looking at and in a manner that perhaps exceeds what a human could observe if they were a foot away. Mm-hmm. And so essentially, we use that imaging. And the images that we collect they're red, green, blue, the same kind of camera, for example, it's on your iPhone, but a little bit more intense. And when we use a dual lens, we have to see depth. I have to know that the grape that's 3 inches behind one grape's 3 inches behind the other.
Yeah.
But I have to be able to account for the fact of their different sizes, even though they're a different spatial distances. So the cameras are quite sophisticated. The AI is extremely sophisticated, so we can see everything. I can tell you a feature. I say this to our customers. I said, look, you hire us, and anybody that works in your company will be able to know that of your 25,000 acres, we will, as many rows as you scan, we will know, that there is mold on that grape, on that cluster, on vine 6, row 7. And so that kind of detail, what's the size of my roots? What are their color? What's the leaf density, shoot density? All the things that anyone would ever want to know, we see that gets translated into actions. And those actions vary depending on the crop, the way the grower is growing. There's some interesting outcomes of this, Brian, that we could talk about. And among them are, and this is the one that I would sort of highlight. And again, I have to use an analogy here because it was something that was surprising to me. So I remember back in the day, I actually saw a pitch, an early version in 2007, of what are now essentially your iWatch.
Right.
You're tracking your fitness, heart rate, blood pressure, all those wonderful things. I remember hearing a pitch back in 2007 and somebody in the audience of venture capitalists say, well, why in the world would you want to track everyone's blood pressure, heart rate, and all these other things? That's what a doctor's for. I just don't see the point. And not many people did, including me at the time, why all that data would be valuable. Because it seemed like a lot of data. It seemed like a lot of detail. And if it were that important, wouldn't we already be collecting it? But what I didn't realize and what nobody realized is once you have it, you start to rethink how you do what you do. And effectively, that's what's happened with our many of our biggest customers. And some of our customers are some of the largest table wine, juice, grape, and blueberry, blackberry growers in the entire world.
So it's a mind shift.
It's a mind shift.
Yeah.
When you know the condition of every plant and everything on that plant on a continuous basis, and it's relatively cheaply had, and the world changes for you.
Right.
You begin to think differently about how I harvest, what treatments I apply, when do I apply those treatments. You then see differences between plants that shouldn't be that different for whatever reason. And now I can respond to those differences. I can treat plants differently. Again, another analogy, by the example of teaching. If everyone had a tutor from the time they were a small child, I think we'd all be further along in our education.
Right.
Problem is, this is not scalable, so we sit in classrooms.
Right.
Same in farming. I couldn't farm to the plant, essentially because I didn't know the condition of the plant. So I have to,
farm to the field.
Yep.
Yeah. So what you've just described, which is absolutely amazing, is it really covers, you know, how can we improve efficiency? We're improving the efficiency utilizing that system.
Yep.
It, you know, you've kind of told us the role that the AI can play in what is now essentially a precision agricultural, it's all specialty crop system, right? And how to monitor and assess the health of every plant, not just the field, right? And then how to be able to combat when, as soon as you see any disparities in health, how to combat that, you know, you can pinpoint that health issue and address that health issue without having to address the entire field, reducing your input costs and so forth. Right. So, you know, obviously that reduces the time that the farmer's in the field.
Yeah.
Could you see robotics and specialty crop systems reducing labor shortage issues that we are currently facing? And how could you see that happening?
Yeah, and funny, we're in, you mentioned this, but we have customers in Peru, Chile, Morocco, Jalisco, Mexico, France, New York State, California. There are labor shortages all over the world. There is no place where there is now plentiful labor, at least in our experience. The way I like to think of AI, and it gets to the labor issue, is AI actually, if you look at a farm, what are the most important roles the human, why are humans working on farms? Well, they have to move equipment around.
Right.
So somebody has to drive it. If it's in the case of specialty crops, somebody got to harvest it. In many cases, you have to use human labor to harvest. And the third thing, what we handle is I have to know the condition of the plants, or I have to know the condition of whatever it is I'm doing. In all three of those activities, perception is the key. Once I've solved the perception problem, hey, where's my tractor and how does the tractor know to not run over the crops or run over a human or turn this corner or do all those things? how does the robot know to grab that apple and do it in a way that doesn't destroy the apple and do it quickly and efficiently? Mm-hmm. And then how does it know what the condition of the plant is as to when to harvest it or what treatment to give it? Right. All three of those are based on, once you've solved the perception problem, once I know what I'm looking at,
right,
where I am, how to move, you basically have dramatically reduced the amount of human labor.
Right.
To, I mean, I don't want to say zero, but very, very yeah. low and very low. You really, so just to use an example, if you can make vehicles autonomous, mm-hmm. You don't need 8-hour shifts.
Right.
Tractors run continuously and the vehicles never stop.
Right.
If you can make vehicles autonomous, say goodbye to the 500 or 600 horsepower mega tractor.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
To the swarm of small tractors, because yes. now you don't need a human again.
Right.
Say goodbye to human accidents and human error.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. Robotics. Same thing with, I can send the robot to harvest the peaches.
Mm-hmm.
It could harvest at a rate that would be unsustainable to the most ambitious humans.
Right.
Do it continuously all day, all night, round the clock. Never
regardless
stop.
Regardless of conditions as well. I mean, even
regardless. Absolutely. Yeah. Regardless of conditions.
Right.
Reduce back injury. Mm-hmm. All of the, you know, really challenging health problems that people that work in that very difficult environment right. typically acquire over years of work. Mm-hmm. Those go away. All that goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And then because you've digitalized everything, I know that this tree, this apple tree, is now a digital artifact.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not somebody looked at it and made a recording and put some notes away and then it's looked at later. You don't have that human interpretation that varies enough to make it not terribly useful. You have a digitalization of that tree. It's a digital artifact. And that digital artifact will change and grow and evolve over time.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have a record of everything I've done to that tree and every outcome over years. So I can see patterns that no farmer could see because they got too many other things to think about, too many other things to worry about. Subtle, nuanced patterns that allow that farmer to make adjustments in those inputs, adjustments in the treatments, and have every plant produced to its maximum without additional resources when you digitalize things.
And this is all AI and machine learning that's doing this on AI, a consistent basis. Yep. Yeah.
Well, it's, I would say it's a combination of factors. It is certainly AI,
mm-hmm.
but it's also the ability of AI. It's the sensing modes right. as well. It's what's happening now in AI and robotics is, I call it the mind body problem. Again, sorry, I use all these crazy analogies.
No, that's great.
We used to think in my previous companies, I used to think, well, I'm going to use an existing sensor cell phone mm-hmm. and I'm going to put it in the windshield and the camera is going to collect the video and then I'll apply AI to it, our, mm-hmm. our bespoke AI.
Mm-hmm.
And what we discovered is very soon the AI runs up against the limits of the cell phone. It wasn't built for this,
mm-hmm.
but we exploit it to the fullest. But the problem is the AI advances, the hardware doesn't. And so you don't get the full benefits of both. And mm-hmm. frankly, you create problems. So the mind-body problem is one where both the hardware and the AI have to evolve together.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just say, I'm going to put AI on this machine.
Mm-hmm.
The machine and the AI have to be built of a kind of a yeah. single strategy and thought. Okay, where that gets challenging is, you mean I have to build hardware just for this purpose? And the answer is yeah. And a lot of companies have been reluctant to do that because what that means is I then have to sell a whole new piece of equipment to this farmer. I can't just go in there and say, oh, here's an attachment you can add to this vehicle or why don't you hook this thing up and you're good to go. And it'll be a modest additional cost. You can capitalize it or it's still different now. It really right. will be a more it will be for a lot of farmers a more significant change in how they do what they do, routines, mm-hmm. How they organize themselves. All these things will change.
So I remember a number of years ago, we had a professor from Ohio State University that came and did a presentation, and he actually talked about how the future of agriculture, even commodity crop farming, that they were going to shift away from the oversized tractors and oversized equipment and precision ag
right.
to bring in more autonomous, smaller vehicles to reduce, yep. The pressure on the ground from the heavy weights of the yeah. vehicles, right? And make, trying to heal the soil and that. So I totally get where that's coming from. So, I can understand completely how the use of robotics in food systems can optimize resource usage, right? Because it's a lot more precision. When they talk about precision ag, this is like precision ag on steroids. Right? How do robotics, what challenges do you think exist in integrating robotics into traditional farming? That's obviously got to be some sort of pitfalls.
There are many challenges. And let's start with the limits of what robotics can do now.
Right.
And I will tell you, and I don't want to sound like a extreme techno optimist here, but the robot technologies that we see now, in 10 years, we will look back and say, mm-hmm. wow, those were toys.
Right.
The rate of advancement of robotic technology, anybody that watches any of those wonderful videos of the robots dancing, mm-hmm. Boston Dynamics robots, that's just the beginning. What's coming? So I'm going to tell you the near-term issues with robotics, which is effectively the challenge of, for example, in the case of robotics, let me frame it this way. I think of three things. I think of autonomization. Mm-hmm. Autonomization would be the vehicles themselves and plants coming together. Mm-hmm. So how do you get the vehicle, the machinery, in and around the farm, moving around seamlessly all by itself?
Right.
That's kind of, think of that as autonomization. It's Tesla mm-hmm. would be an example
for
autonomous cars. And then I think robotization would be the often hand labor that is required mm-hmm. once the vehicle is in place. What does it do? Picking apples, picking mm-hmm. fruit, all that, packing, things like that.
Yeah.
And then I think of digitalization, which is taking all of the
data,
all of the data, turning those plants into sort of a digital form.
Right.
Where robotization is challenged right now is developing relatively affordable robots that can pick apples.
Right. Without crushing them.
Yeah, that can pick cabbage.
Right, right, right.
And what I think every roboticist would dream of is there would be a universal robot that probably would look like a human.
Right.
And that's great, but that's not how roboticists think right now. They can't. They think of equipment that is custom built for a particular crop.
Right.
And the challenge that a farmer has is when you build machinery very specific to a specific problem, it's not very versatile for other problems. I look at farming equipment. It's hundreds of, couple hundred years of experience has, shown people that make farming equipment how to make it thoughtfully. Mm-hmm. Robots are not that way. Robots require a lot more specialization and a lot more things unique to that robot. So you don't have that general purpose robot yet.
Yeah.
So in the absence of that, the solutions often are limited in what they can do and very expensive. Mm-hmm. And because they're new and you're using them on an industrial scale, they're somewhat fragile.
Right.
You think of robots in the auto industry, they've been around since the 50s or 60s. Mm-hmm. But those robots are doing routines now. Yeah. More recently, it's a little different. But for decades, they said, well, robots work in factories. Why do they work on a farm? Anybody who's been in a factory knows that a factory is very different from being outside on a farm.
Oh, yeah. Conditions are different. They're doing the exact same movement, repetitive movements, over and over and over. If you've got an autonomous vehicle that's roving around undulating ground, trying to harvest apples that one is one size and one is another size.
Right.
So, the what you've described, the automation seems to be, not as big of a challenge. The data and visualization, not as big of a challenge, the AI components there. But the roboticism, because if you think about commodity crops, corn and soy, you've got thousands of acres with the same plant spaced exactly the same spacings apart. You could do that, because that is a repetitive motion like you have a robot in a factory. Right. In a specialty crop grower farm, 9 times out of 10, they've got 10, 15 different crops. And if you've got one robot for one crop, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
I think what you will see, and again, I'm making another wild prediction, and people can laugh at when they hear this in 10 years and laugh at me, then. If you look at, I'll use a historic example, the steam engine and the way factories were powered. Back in the 1800s, when you had a factory that used the steam engine, there was a central steam engine, and then there were all these belts and pulleys, so the different machines could utilize this single steam engine that sat at the end of this huge building. And so all these belts and pulleys would allow the lathe or the drill or all these other machinery. And so you had to build a factory in a way to accommodate the steam engine so that the factory would function.
Right.
And then somebody came along with the idea of electric motors. And what electric motors did is they actually released that constraint. So now I could have machinery sitting anywhere and factory could take any form.
Right.
At some level, I think that's what's going to happen with robotics and automation on farms. What will happen is, as the robot technology evolves, farming, the physical farming, the way farms are structured themselves may change so that machine and crop and sort of man and machine can accommodate one another and do it in a way to optimize both. Right now, machine or robots are being thrown into a world that was basically established hundreds of years ago. And the machineries that exist right now have existed to accommodate that reality about how farms are organized. Well, robots might not need that. They might not require it to be structured that way. And it may may result in a further optimization of how a farm is organized. And so what you may see is crops may take different physical form. They may be the farm itself may be organized in a way that's very different than the shape of most farms you see today. You see glimmers of it, for example, with the way apple trees are grown now, where they trellised.
Yeah.
You know, it looks weird, but
it's not a tree. It's almost like a bonsai.
It's a bonsai.
That are trellised up against wires, it's just, and they're in rows.
And, and it seems unnatural. You know, it makes me uncomfortable, the poor tree, poor apple tree. But effectively, you're going to see variations of that. And it will be a way to allow both to be optimized. And so when I say farming will change, I really mean in every way.
Right. That's an interesting point. I've never really thought about it, that in order to make sure that robotics can work, the way that we farm has to change in order to allow, so that it's not, we're just waiting for robotics to make every leap and bound to get to where we need to fit with what we're currently doing. We need to change in order to allow robotics to get into the playing field much sooner.
And with the central goal, if I always call this, with apologies to my high school, Catholic high school upbringing, the what I call the Trinity, the Holy Trinity. Increase volume, increase the volume of the yield, increase the quality of the yield, increase the consistency of the yield. And do it in a cost-effective way. And so when you release the constraint of, well, the farm has to be physically this way, when you release that constraint and you allow the two to kind of optimize, you get performance across all three of those.
Right. So we talk about the economics of it. I'm sure it's going to be like anything, right? You know, when something comes out, when computers first came out, totally expensive, Right. Very few people had them, but as they as technology went, you know, obviously it got cheaper.
Right.
How long is it before you think you could see the use of these technologies on small to mid-sized family farms, which if you look in the United States are still the majority of farms, right? How many years do you think it's going to be before we get to that scale where I've got 30 acres and I'm, you know, and I'm growing for a local farmer's market or a CSA? How long before I can see robotics in that kind of a situation?
I'll use cell phones as an example. I work for Texas Instruments. Texas Instruments made the innards of a lot of cell phones. So I was uniquely as an employee of this company, I was able to get early cell phones. Mm-hmm. And you're talking the early 90s, late 80s. Mm-hmm. That was a rich person's toy.
Oh, yeah.
If you remember, like, you know, famous movie from Wall Street where Michael Douglas is walking on with the big...
He's got that, the big phone on the side,
You know, that was like a rich person's, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Great scene. Now, literally, there are more phones than people, I think, in the world, actually. Mm-hmm. And so that whole process took about 15 years to get to a level where everybody in the world could have a phone. And mm-hmm. and ultimately, in 20 years from the late 80s, to where everybody had a smartphone.
Right.
About 18 to, it was somewhere around 15 to 18 years.
Right.
It will not take that long. Because for farming, in my humble opinion, because the rate at which these technologies, AI and others, are evolving itself is accelerating. Mm-hmm. So the rate of progress in these technologies is itself accelerating. So you see that in a lot of industries and a lot of technologies now where, you know, I remember as a kid that, you know, the cars would change every 4 years. You know, all of those things are now greatly compressed. Mm-hmm. And will increasingly so. And I say this because, principally because, and again, it's just my opinion here, once you've solved the perception problem, everything else is mechanical engineering, electromechanical engineering, materials, all the things that we know how to do in many cases can now be applied at scale in a more thoughtful way once you solve the perception problem.
Right.
And the perception problem isn't entirely solved, but it's pretty far along. So for example, if I were to use autonomous vehicles, we have autonomous vehicles on the road in the United States now, and they work. Mm-hmm. They don't work in every way we want them to and need them to, but they work. And within 5 years, I joke that your grandchildren will ask you one day, talking about driving a car, be like riding a horse to work. Weren't you scared? And, you know, how did you do that? And I mean, it is a fact of life. Wow. And so I think that where it will go to the mid-sized farmer, it will probably be both directions, just like most technologies. It'll go from the kind of elite user. And we have some of our customers, you know, our vintners, they sell a bottle of wine for $5,000.
Right.
Very high end. They use this data in very clever, thoughtful ways. Mm-hmm. So you'll have high end users evolving the performance of the technology. Mm-hmm. And then you'll have industrial users who maybe don't use it in the same way as the high end users, mm-hmm. but are making it more affordable and scalable. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of those two users in agriculture using mm-hmm. these tools, the cost and it will come down, the performance will go up. Mm-hmm. When you reach, it'll reach a certain point where that sort of price performance ratio then becomes affordable for the rest of us. Just like cell phones became affordable for the rest of us. The price performance ratio, because of the industrial scale users and the sort of premium high end, you know, technology at any price users, pushing the performance there, pushing the cost down here, mm-hmm. it'll become affordable. And I would say, you know, within 10 years, a lot of what are considered interesting technologies or even exotic will probably be fairly common within 10 years.
Wow. So I know I saw an article just the other day that Bloomfield was recently acquired by Kubota.
Yes.
Actually, as you mentioned to me prior to this conversation, that that happened the day that you and I were busy chit-chatting, so you couldn't talk about it, but now you can. So I wanted to
tell you, Brian, but I was forbidden. But
let's talk a little bit about that. So tell me, can you just expand upon it and then tell me, you know, your long-term thoughts about what this means for agriculture when a company like Kubota wants to get involved with the work that you're doing with Flash, right?
I think anybody who wants to see advance in technology and ag tech should feel really good about this acquisition, because Kubota being a global player, major player, particularly in specialty crops, but also in row crops globally.
Right.
It's a 130-year-old company, a Japanese industrial company that produces tractors and a variety of other technologies. You know, Japanese companies have a reputation for being very deliberate when they make decisions, but once they've made the choice, they're all in.
Right.
So I think people should look at this as not an experiment by Kubota, but as a deliberate effort on their part, a long-term effort to recognize that the digitalization of plants and providing the full suite of services to farmers is a fact of life. So I would say to people, look at Kubota and perhaps other tractor companies as moving beyond just providing equipment to actually providing what I would call digital services to the farmer and providing that window into detail and that they just, the farmers don't have access to now. So what you'll see probably from a Kubota in the not too distant future is a whole suite of services designed to improve the productivity and efficiency and performance of farmers around the world. And this this technology, this product that we built over 5 years is at the center of it. And so it's exciting. Kubota is a wonderful partner. They've been an investor in us for a period of about 2.5 years. They've been a very patient investor and a very helpful one. And so we've learned a lot about farming. Their global presence has helped us as well. And it became in our conversations with them, I think, obvious to both of us that together we could really make a difference for farmers. They could provide the scale, the access, the vehicles, and we could provide the perception piece and some experience. And it just made for a great partnership. I think you may, and then if I may speculate even further, those who watch ag tech, I'm going to make a prediction. I think you will see other companies arise and other combinations of companies, tech companies with big companies like John Deere and Kubota and CNH and all the other players.
Right.
We'll start to see what Kubota is doing and say, hey, we've got to get into that too. So you're going to see, I think for those who watch ag tech, you know, Brian, you know, you're going to see a lot of dynamic change in the next 3 to 5 years.
So, I mean, I could totally see, because Flash is the name of the product, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, from the images that I've seen, Flash, you have dual cameras, right?
Yeah.
So you call them stereo cameras. I could totally see them actually building them into the body or into the machine, and having it as a, you know, a component that is just a value added component in the tractor.
You can imagine, much like, again, forgive the analogies. I apologize.
Right.
My colleagues, I drive them nuts with all these analogies.
I love analogies. Keep going.
If you buy a car today, you have satellite radio embedded in.
Exactly.
The car company doesn't own satellite radio.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want satellite radio, you hit a button and you start a subscription.
That's right.
And so the vehicle is a means for you to access this service.
Right.
That you choose to either use or not use. Mm-hmm. Same thing. If I buy a vehicle and I have the embedded sensing capability, I might choose this year to use their sensing, use Bloomfield sensing on my Kubota tractor.
Yeah.
And I just hit a button and the telematics and the communication systems that are existent in the tractor take over from there.
Yeah.
The cloud services, all those things, they're just invisible to the farmer. It's happening in the background. And that farmer who's never left their building probably that day, but has essentially, you know, sprayed and done work on, you know, a third of their farm with their various vehicles, sits down after dinner with a glass of wine and now can know exactly the condition of every right. plant, the entire farm, and everything that's been done to it, knows with, you know, with extreme accuracy and precision.
Right. Now, for our audience and those that are listening, I'm sure there's a number of folks that don't realize that the majority of tractors that are out there now come fully capable with computer satellite data. You know, yeah. a lot of them, you can just, you know, once you programmed it, you just press a button and you just sit there. You yep. don't actually drive it. The satellite navigation right. system does all of the driving for you.
Right.
And you're just there as a monitoring asset, right?
Exactly.
Now, the one thing I will say, though, when you look at rural communities, the biggest challenge for a program such as a Flash, especially data collection, is the lack of rural internet service, right?
Connectivity, yeah.
The connectivity piece.
I can tell you a little vignette about that. So
yeah, please go.
I was reached out to by Deutsche Telekom. So for any mm-hmm. of those who listening in Europe know that Deutsche Telekom is one of the biggest telecom providers across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been, they called me and asked, you know, how does this system work? And they concluded, they said, and I said, why are you reaching out to me? You know, we're in ag, what do we have to do with?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, we believe that there's a blue ocean opportunity for us telecom providers in rural places. And if we're simply just going to add a little bit of capacity, it's really not worth us to build the infrastructure we need to do the kind of significant data transmission. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, your world's going to change. So I encourage you to take a relook at everything you're doing, because the volumes of data that we are collecting and processing mm-hmm. and moving around are vast. Mm-hmm. And if you do this on a large scale, you really sort of, you know, take it to its logical conclusion. These vehicles are massive data collection sponges, mm-hmm. and they are going to be collecting and processing vast amounts of data. When you're looking at a stalk of corn, and you're looking at the features of a single stalk of corn on a continuous basis, you're looking at massive amounts of data. And so now I think what you may see is the AT&Ts of the world, Verizons and Deutsche Telekoms, Canal Plus, others, they're going to look at rural infrastructure as an opportunity, because mm-hmm. they're not just looking as the farmer as the customer. They're looking at the Kubota Corporation,
right, exactly.
John Deere as the farm, as
that's
the customer.
Right. That's where the money's at, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly. So when it comes to that type of, when it comes to the data that Flash collects, what different types of data does it capture during its process and on the crops? And I just want to point out to the audience once again that the majority of the crops that Flash is used on right now is specialty crops. It's in grapes. It's in berry
crops.
Production, right? It's not in, commodity crops, right?
Yep.
So what kind of data?
Yeah. So the way to think of it is we use what's called red, green, you know, RGB imaging, just sort of like your cell phone, although the cameras are very specialized. They use what's sometimes called a global shutter. We have our own light source, so we don't worry about ambient light. And of course, as you said, we use stereo imaging so we can see depth. We have to be able to create a 3D image of what we see to see everything. So our sensing mode is like a human sensing mode. Now, because it's digitalized, we can see more detail than a human would see if they were standing a foot away from it. There's things we can see that you couldn't see if you were looking right at it, the level of detail, and you're seeing it consistently.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think of it not just of what you're sensing, but the nature of how you're sensing it. You're creating a digital artifact that you can relook at again and again, try different models, apply different models with new knowledge again and again and all that. What we originally thought of is, what if we added infrared or some other multispectral beyond the RGB a traditional sort of RGB imaging. Somebody said LiDAR and all these other things. And we could. There were other sensing modes we could add that would have added to the richness of the data. But we made a practical decision early on and said, if we do that, we'll get more data, but does it materially increase the utility of the information? Mm-hmm. Every tech company has to make that choice. I get more data, but am I improving the decision I'm informing that much? Right.
Is it just junk data or is this specific?
Exactly. And if I get more data, right, I add more sensors, I increase the cost.
Yeah, exactly.
Sensing mode.
Right.
So we had to make some judgments, some engineering trade-offs, and basically went with RGB. But what you may see in the future is we're going to combine it with other sensing modes. Mm-hmm. And this is where AI and perception are at the boundary of, you know, another phenomenon you're going to see more of, which is kind of interesting. Some people call it physical AI. So the AI that we all think of, ChatGPT, is AI in the digital world, which is terrific. But now with robotics, we're talking about AI in the physical world. This is machines that move around, robots that pick cherries, that sort of thing. And just like a human, to move around, we don't just use sight. We use our sound, our balance, our taste, our smell, touch to move.
Right.
And no one knows how all these different sensing modes are fused in the brain to allow us to do what we do. But that's what a roboticist are trying to do right now. They're basically in the mode now of saying, how can I take an infrared LiDAR and an RGB image? How can I take the data from all of those sensing modes and then fuse it in a clever way to get information I could not get from a single sensor alone?
Hmm.
And that's sometimes called multimodal sensing. And it is it's a frontier.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're talking, you know, Terminator type stuff here.
When you're talking, you're
really getting into the science fiction-y kind of stuff, but that's what's happening. Wow. So that way you'll be able to, you know, as everyone knows, who's seen satellite images of farms, mm-hmm. or some drones that use IR to look at light absorption and all that. If you could combine that with these other sensing modes and in a sense fuse them to extract what I call knowledge, plant knowledge, you're in business.
Wow. So in terms of what Flash analyzes, are there specific plant features that it's looking for?
We take our cue from the grower, so we can see everything. So when we look at it, I'll use a blueberry bush or vine, let's use a vineyard. We are looking at the grapes. So we're counting the grapes, we're counting the clusters, the shape of the clusters, the average size of each grape, the color of the grape, even individual features on a grape. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the leaves, their shape, their color, their size, their density, shoots, everything a human can see, we see also.
Wow.
And we see it at a level of detail, and again, in some ways, where the human would not perceive it.
So and every piece of that is being analyzed?
Every piece of it's being analyzed. Now, the question will be, then, what are you producing? And here's where the farmer comes in. So I like to say that every farmer has their own recipe. Which we believe it's true. Every farmer comes at it with their own, you know, we harvest blueberries when they've reached, when 64% of the plant reaches this color threshold and not more than 10 beyond this color, time to harvest.
Right.
Grower down the street, same variety of blueberries, different approach.
Right.
So on and on. And those differences have to be accommodated. And so what we do is the farmer then sets the scale in the systems and says, all right, when I see this average size, this density of leaves, when I see these features on the leaf. So for example, we look at disease infestation and the grower will say, I want you to see Flavescens dorée. I want you to see Phylloxera and, you know, whatever else they want us to see.
Right.
And the system will be set to see those things. Mm-hmm. To what degree? Well, what level of density, you know, that you want to be alerted at plant level now, plant level.
Right.
when grapes reach a certain size, when a certain percentage of clusters mm-hmm. of a certain size reach a certain density with a certain color, mm-hmm. please tell me, on and on and on. So the grower can then set the standards at which they want to be
parameters that they
formed, and then they come up with their own formula. And what I like to say is that allows us to then provide plant knowledge.
Yeah.
Not plant data, plant knowledge.
Plant knowledge, yeah. So, I mean, my next question was going to go into, does Flash have the ability to help them with harvest planning? And you've just described exactly how it does. Because inside their recipe, what they have told the system is, these are the criteria that I'm looking for. Once Flash sees that criteria, you give me the heads up, and then I'll go out there as the human piece of it, go double cross check, and then I know now's the time. We bring out the machines, let's harvest.
And Brian, there's another dimension this I think is particularly interesting, is when you are looking at all of your plants every week, or in some cases different times of year, every day, for your entire farm from February on, your yield predictions are a lot better.
Oh yeah.
you know, there's no more guessing. Like you've got a pretty detailed knowledge of how your farm is performing when you have that level of detail, that extraordinary level of detail.
Right. So in terms of the data collection, what is, from a sustainability standpoint, what impact does it have on sustainability in agriculture?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's TBD. And I mean that because we're just learning that ourselves. So when we have, let me give you an example. I can't name the parties.
Right.
But imagine a grocery chain, and you buy a bag of apples, and on the bag is a QR code, and you put your phone over the QR code, and it tells you the tree, it shows you the tree that these apples came from.
Wow.
And then the history of that tree,
mm-hmm.
and everything that's ever been done to that tree, every chemical that's been layered on that tree, mm-hmm. when it was applied, the labor associated with it, the provenance of that, of those apples to the bush.
Right.
And people will say, that sounds ridiculous, but it's not.
Not to me. No,
it's not. In
people want that information. They want to know where their food comes from, right?
Exactly. And in livestock, you essentially, you know, if you're eating a steak, that restaurant probably could find out where, what cow that steak came from.
Right.
Now, for sustainability, one of the motivating factors for the company was the idea that we could replace water, fertilizer, pesticides, not completely, but to some extent, with data.
Right.
If you can apply those essential ingredients, those essential inputs, in a much more thoughtful way,
right,
probably will use less of them.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There was a one of our investors is one of the largest cotton farmers in the mm-hmm. south of the United States, and mm-hmm. he regularly hires people to tell him what to spray and how much or where. Mm-hmm. And he joked with me. He goes, I call the guy, the consultant I hire, Mr. Spray Everything. And I said, why is that? Because every recommendation he gives me is, well, just spray everything.
Right.
You know, and he said what he would hoped there'd be a little bit more discerning application of these expensive mm-hmm. resources that, frankly, there aren't many of them. And I think that if you go forward, you know, we talk about this in the company a lot. There's no more arable land.
Oh yeah, we're not making anymore.
This is it. And the water table in the United States is going down, as it is in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The fertilizers that are common today probably will disappear in 2015 or 20 years.
Yeah.
The pesticides that are currently being applied are already now being questioned and will be, and likely will probably change or disappear.
Right.
Labor shortages will get more and more critical.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the other resources that are consumed, often the consumption is a function of the fact that it's kind of like Mr. Spray everything. It's done in an undiscerning way and oversprayed, overused. And if you can apply the basic principles of precision agriculture developed 50 years ago, you can dramatically reduce those resources and increase the performance of that farm and that holy trinity. So that's our hope, and we can do that with data.
That's a great hope. It really is. So is Flash available now for purchase, or is it still in its testing?
You buy it as a, and so Brian, you buy it as a service. So I equate it to much like a cell phone service.
Yeah.
You pay a flat fee, and now I can access the internet and call people and do everything else I want with the phone, and I just pay a flat fee. If I don't have a phone, a piece of hardware, I can go to AT&T and they'll amortize the cost of the phone into that flat fee. I can get out of the contract if I want, ultimately, same thing. So they're not necessarily buying equipment. They're just basically
paying for
buying
service.
A service
for
a monthly fee. And then they use the, and we send them the hardware. They get a Pelican case and they're in business, and it's easy to hook up. Takes 20 minutes or so. Doesn't, you know, depending on what kind of vehicle you have, you just connect into the power source, pretty easy there, hit a button, go. And a lot of times the growers will say, well, how many, you know, cameras should I use? And think of it this way. If you're on a vehicle sensibly going, you know, 7 or 8 miles an hour, you're probably going to be able to cover your farm of 300 acres and get 100% coverage.
Wow.
So if you are a grower of 200, you know, 100 to 300 acres, one camera is probably more than sufficient. If your farm is in the 500 to 10,000 or 20 or 30, you know, if you're one of these really big farmers, you'll want more than one camera on more than one vehicle.
Wow. And, you know, from a cost perspective, what does the system and what does the service run?
You know, let me just
put it this way. Is it in the hundreds of dollars, the thousands of dollars, or the tens of thousands of dollars?
It's in the thousands of dollars.
Thousands of dollars. Okay.
Yeah. This is not a $100,000 hardware acquisition or some massive service that you, the farmers, this is in an affordable range.
Right.
Or even small farmers.
Right.
So we really want it, and it'll increasingly be so. So what you'll find is the system's performance will increase. The versatility of the system will grow, and likely the costs will come down, and probably the price will as along with it as well.
So when we talk about specialty crop growers, you know, there's a lot of movement for urban ag as well.
Yeah.
Could you see the size of the Flash unit being reduced to smaller scale, less than a size of a toaster that could be put on, say, something that looks like a Roomba, for example?
You know, Brian, we actually started it in handheld version.
Oh, wow.
So we built a handheld version, and we built it for cannabis. So effectively, we still have it. We pursued the, you know, limited venture-backed company with limited resource. We had to make some choices, but effectively, it's a version, it's the exact same version, but it's handheld, and one would, in a cannabis farm, you would essentially put it up against the leaf. It would have a lens and its own light source, and it would image the plant, and it would count and size and color the trichomes. AI would see all the trichomes, come up with their size and color, and then tell the grower what the THC content was, because the harvest window in cannabis, I think, is just a few days. And if you're wrong, it's like 20-30% of the value of the crop. So you could do that with anybody, any tomatoes, you name it. You can use the handheld version, which we don't sell. But what we'll end up doing is probably, I think, maybe perhaps in the future, that might be something that would be a complement to the Flash camera.
Right.
You could do it that way. In some cases, we had tests in indoor farms where you would suspend it, you know, be sort of permanently above or adjacent to a table of plants, for example. But we just didn't pursue that. But that's also, there are some companies that are trying to do that now in indoor grows. I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say this with absolute confidence. The plant level management, and what we do or what other people are trying to do is just a fact of life in farming, starting in specialty crops and probably expanding into broad acre row crops.
Right. Well, I got to say, Mark, this is absolutely amazing. I love it. This, you know, the addition of technology is, I'm a big believer in regionalization of our food system, and things like this are going to give opportunities for traditional row crop farmers to diversify some of what they do into specialty crop growing, because they've got, you know, machine learning and AI that's taking care of the rest of the stuff. They can spend some time growing food for human consumption. So I love it. I love the work. And congratulations on the acquisition by Kubota.
Appreciate it.
It seems like an amazing opportunity. And I'm tickled pink to think of what it could mean for ag, and especially crop growing down the line. So once again, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated. So ladies and gentlemen, that was Mark DeSantis from Bloomfield joining us to talk about Flash and robotics in agriculture. We thank you for joining us on Innovation Conversation.